Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. We'll be speaking today with the brilliant poet, essayist, and nonfiction writer and professor Paisley Rekdal. We'll be talking with her about her brand new book, Imaginary Vessels. It's out with Copper Canyon Press. It's a fantastic read. No doubt after our interview, you'll want to go and pick it up. I have no doubt about that. We'll also be talking with Paisley about her work on working with the Amy Lowell Traveling Scholarship. You know, she traveled all around the world. That's a fantastic and a very prestigious fellowship, actually, that allots poets about a year abroad, and the only, I think, stipulation is that they cannot return to the United States for an entire year. And she was part of that. She received that fellowship, and we'll get into that conversation as well. Paisley's work has been very influential to me personally. I came across her work, gosh, years ago, over 10, 15 years ago, maybe, when she wrote her book, The Night My Mother Met Bruce Lee. And that book became very, very influential in my first attempt at a novel, which was Breathing in Dust. And, you know, we'll get into asking her some questions about that as well. And, you know, the LA Times just recently said about her new book, Imaginary Vessels, they said this deserves to be her breakout book, and I could not agree with them more. We look forward to speaking with Paisley Rekdal, and we invite you to join us coming up on Words on a Wire. Paisley Rekdal is the author of a book of essays, The Night My Mother Met Bruce Lee, a hybrid genre photo text memoir entitled Intimate, and four books of poetry, A Crash of Rhinos, Six Girls Without Pants, The Invention of the Kaleidoscope, and Animal Eye, which was a finalist for the 2013 Kingsley Tufts Prize, the Balcones Prize, and numerous other prizes. Her latest book, Imaginary Vessels, has just been published. It is a book-length essay. The Broken Country on Trauma, a Crime, and the Continuing Legacy of Vietnam is forthcoming in 2017. She has received numerous awards and fellowships, including the Guggenheim, the Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Fellowship, and the NEA, amongst many others. Her work has appeared in journals such as New York Times Magazine, American Poetry Review, the Kenyan Poetry Review, and the New Republic, as well as the Best American Poetry Series. She currently teaches at the University of Utah, where she is also the creator and editor of the community web project Mapping Salt Lake City, Utah. Paisley Rekdal, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. It's a pleasure to have you. And I know that you have been on our show probably years ago, I think maybe back in 2012 or something like that. Is that
yep,
right?
That's right. Probably around the time that both Intimate and Animal Eye came out.
That's right. It was Animal Eye. Yeah, that's right. That's what I saw that we had in our archives here. I mean, it was great. I thought, well, good timing. We can have her back for this wonderful book. And I really appreciated and enjoyed the book Imaginary Vessels, which is the newest book you have out, right?
Yes, it is.
Cool. And it's with Copper Canyon Press. Would you mind starting off our listeners with a poem? Why don't we kick it off with a poem?
All right. Well, I will start with the poem Vessels, actually,
cool,
which is, to a certain extent, gave me the idea for the title of the collection.
Mm.
And one thing I should say about the poem is I was living in Vietnam at the time, and this is, in a weird way, a kind of global warming poem by accident, because I was doing a tour of Ha Long Bay, and we went to a pearl farm, and it turns out that the waters were heating up so much that the oysters were dying, and so they were trying to figure out how to turn mussels into vessels for pearl production. So basically what I was looking at was a whole sort of production line in which they were taking the beginning of a seed pearl and taking it from an oyster and inserting it into a mussel. So I thought about that for a while. Yeah, it's a kind of crazy process.
I want to ask you about that after the poem. That's interesting.
Yeah. Vessels. Shouldn't it ache, this slit into the sweet and salt mix of waters composing the mussel, its labial meats winged open, yellow-fleshed, black and gray around the tough adductor? It hurts to imagine it, regardless of the harvester's denials, swiveling his knife to make the incision, one dull cyst nicked from the oyster's mantle, its thread of red gland no bigger than a seed of trout roe pressed inside this mussel's tendered flesh. Both hosts eased open with a knife, as if anything could be said to be eased with a knife, so that one pearl after another can be harvested, polished, added to others until a single rope is strung on silk, linked by what you think is pain. Nothing could be so roughly handled and yet feel so little. Your pity turned into part of this production, you with your small, four-chambered heart. Shyness, hungers, envy. What in you could be so precious you would cleave another to keep it close? Imagine the weeks it takes to wind nacre over the red seed placed at another heart's mantle. The mussel become what no one wants to. Vessel, caisson, wounded into making us the thing we want to call beautiful.
Wow, that's fantastic. If you're just tuning into our program, we are speaking with poet Paisley Rechtel, who has a brand new collection of poetry called Imaginary Vessels, and she just read the poem Vessels from that. Going back a little bit, Paisley, to the initial experience that prompted this poem, I just find it interesting that, you know, you're in a country and suddenly there's this kind of a oyster production thing happening that when you travel, are you typically looking for these kinds of, you know, what inspires you to like look in these kind of really kind of, I guess, smaller, tiny corners of the world?
You know, I don't know. I'm a big museum fan,
right,
in general, so I will tend to go to any kind of small or large museum.
Right.
And factories are not usually places where you get to have tours or anything like that. It
right.
literally was just the boat was going by, and he said, oh, I think they were trying to sell us pearls. And they said, right. Do you want to see all of these things? And I said, well, sure. You know, you never know. I mean,
sure. Yeah.
The thing about poetic inspiration and
yeah.
is that you just don't know where inspiration's going to happen. And for a while, I had written up a draft of this, and I left it on my computer, and I thought it was a dead draft, actually. I thought, oh, nothing's going on with this. And then sometimes when I'm having a hard time writing, I'll go back and I'll look at drafts that didn't go anywhere and see if there's something I can salvage or start with an image.
Right.
And I saw this, and I thought, wow, now I know what this poem is about. At first, I thought I was writing a poem just about, wow, what it's like to harvest a pearl. And I thought, no, that's not the really interesting thing. The really interesting thing is the fact that they're using a completely different sort of species to harvest this, to grow it, and what it would be like to do this very tiny surgical procedure, and the ways in which, you know, here we have this value mm-hmm. added to the pearl, but because of it, we're sort of basically harvesting another species and trying to use it for our benefit in a way that, you know, I can't help but think of it as somewhat painful, even though
sure.
of course, the harvester says it's not painful.
Yeah.
They don't feel anything.
Yeah, of course. Because we don't ask the oysters, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Ask the oysters,
yeah.
ask the mussels. I'm sure
yeah,
they're
exactly.
experiencing something. And of course, that, you know, all of us, to a certain extent, end up being vessels for somebody else's experiences, memories, and things like that. And sometimes that's both pleasurable and sometimes that's very painful.
Sure.
I mean, when families tell each other stories and we think about all the things that make us who we are, we want to transfer that on, whether to a child or a friend or something like that. I mean, it's an imaginary transfer, but
sure.
it's a transfer nonetheless.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that is throughout this collection of poetry I find is, you know, you mentioned how, you know, you're a fan of museums. And actually, now that I think about it, the book has that kind of a quality from beginning to end, almost as if you are entering a space with these very fine particulars that are obviously in your poems. You know, even from the cover, from the book cover, and, you know, I know our listeners can't see it, but it's a fantastic book cover, and it's yellow, and it has these sort of collection jars, and there's these little critters inside of it. One has a bird and things you might capture, vessels, obviously. And then throughout, and then towards the latter part of the book, you even introduce photographs, and, you know, we'll get into that as well. But the book itself has a total kind of almost a museum quality in that there's a space that you're entering when you read it. Is that a kind of an accurate assessment maybe of...
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. It's not something I'd actually been going for, but,
right.
you know, as you say it, it makes complete sense because I had been teaching a course called Cabinets of Wonder, and I was basically, we were living in London at the time, and I was taking a group of students around with a friend of mine who's an art historian, and we were giving tours. The art historian would talk about these different, the rise of museum culture and cabinets of curiosity, and I would talk about the poems and stories that had been inspired by museums. And so I've been thinking a lot about issues of display and collection and poetry. You know, we do call them poetry collections, and
right.
each poem is its own sort of object, and so any kind of book of poetry becomes a kind of cabinet of wonder. But because
cabinet
I was interested
I
in the
that.
As I became fascinated by the idea of vessels in general, and of course that's what museums do. They give you a series of objects, and they simultaneously invite you to admire the object,
mm-hmm.
but then to sort of speculate and imagine and interpret for yourself. But of course, you know, that speculation and imagination is so personal, so subjective. At the same time, it's so arranged by the space of the museum. And so there's a lot, I think, that's a crossover between the way a poetry collection works and a collection within a museum.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm curious, too, about the writing process. You know, you mentioned that you had this original poem, Vessels, sort of stored away for quite some time after the experience of there with the mussels and the production and all that. Do you find yourself in that instant, did you write that poem there on the spot, or, you know, return to your wherever you're staying and write it? Or is it something that only when you return home, you write from memory?
It's a good question. It's sort of a combination of all three things. I actually keep a little notepad on me most times, and so I'm always jotting down certain things. And it's a little annoying, and I get embarrassed because it seems very precious for me to somehow, I'll be in the middle of something, and I'll be like, wait, I have to write this down, you know, and you scuttle away into a dark corner and start writing some stuff in.
Totally.
So try not to do that. You know, I try not to be that person.
Yeah, try.
It's exactly everyone's stereotype of the poet, you know, like, oh, yeah. I'm so, oh, light inspiration. But oftentimes I don't get a poem right there. I get some language, or I find a description that interests me from a book or from a painting or something, and I try and take some of that language. And then I go home and I assemble things from memory. And then, of course, when you go back to the edited versions, you're always sort of changing and moving and rearranging things. So you're always kind of adding. So it's a constant process. But I will say for this book, I would say what was unusual about this book is most of it was written over the course of a year after I had this wonderful fellowship called the Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Fellowship.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. That's a great one. Congratulations on that. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, it was fantastic. You're supposed to live outside the North American continent for 1 year,
right.
And I was happy to do that. They pay you to do that.
Right.
So I lived in Paris for half the year and travel around from there, and then I lived in Vietnam for the other half of the year and travel around from there.
Awesome.
But I found that I was so intimidated by having been given this great fellowship and this money and this opportunity that it actually shut me down creatively.
Oh,
for a
wow.
So I
the pressure,
a lot
the kind of the pressure factor.
Yeah, I mean, I was just like, well, there's so many poets that would deserve something like this. Why did they give it to me?
Right.
You know, why am I here? You know,
all
I better do something really, really good. And I started panicking, and so I ended up just taking reams of notes. And I felt like I wasn't writing a lot during that whole year, which made me feel even worse. But then I got home, and suddenly it was just poem after poem after poem after poem came. And and they were based around a lot of the notes that I had taken. So there was something about being back in a space that was... I was happy to be home, but, you know, it was a little boring compared to, like, living in Paris, you know, Hanoi. And it gave me the space to actually start imagining and feel free to write again. So this book came kind of posthumously in some respects for in that sense, you know, like the time I was given.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think every published poet in the United States at some point or another may have probably applied for that fellowship, the Amy Lowell traveling one. It's always been fascinating to me that I always imagined that if one day I would get that specific scholarship, you know, where would I want to go? Even that seems daunting, you know, just where would you want to go, first of all? And then on top, to have to produce is like, whoa, I would imagine how daunting that could be.
It is. It's definitely first world problems. But at the same time,
right.
You know, it is kind of embarrassing. You don't realize how guilty you feel about certain things. And also, leaving your life for a year is much harder than you would imagine. I mean, everything, you kind of have to top down, rearrange everything in your life. And so by the time you leave, you're just so exhausted because, you know, you're like, wow, I've had to pack up my house and I've had to figure out, you know, who's going to be taking care of this thing and that thing. And I had to leave my job and will I get it back? You know,
it's kind of... Will my desk still be there? My office still be there?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So there's all sorts of things that kind of go through your mind. And so when you finally leave, your first month is just kind of like lying around being exhausted and, you know, setting up a house in a new place. But it's a, you know, it's a fantastic, fantastic experience. And I really hope that one day I get rich so I can set up a trust like that and give grants to other people.
Absolutely.
I mean, I was telling friends that the one thing that's wonderful about the Amy Lowell is it's a whole year, but that makes it actually unworkable for so many artists that I know.
Yeah.
They can't leave. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to be able to give people a month, you know,
right.
or two or 3 weeks or maybe 2 months or something like that, because especially with people with kids, they just can't do this.
Yeah, absolutely. So. It makes it very difficult. And then, if I'm correct, with that specific fellowship there, you have to stay outside of the United States. You can't return unless there's some special condition or something like that, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So you actually are committed.
Yeah, you're really committed. Yeah. And it's hard because my husband couldn't go. And so it was like a year sabbatical from my marriage, too. And, you know, that was not the easiest thing that we've ever done,
sure.
I'll say that. So, of course, if you're writing about how much fun you're having, you're also lying. Like, I was keeping a blog.
You're lying.
And people are like, wow, your time doesn't sound so pleasant. And I'm like, no, it's actually wonderful, but I can't actually keep talking about how much fun I'm having because this sounds terrible to my husband. Like, I'm having an awesome time without you. And, you know, he came and visited me for what little time he could get off of work, but it certainly wasn't the same thing.
I would imagine. I think all of my, if I was out there, all of my writings, all of my journal entries would be about being homesick.
Yeah, and you do get homesick.
I bet. Wow. If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with poet and author Paisley Rechtel, who has a brand new book, Imaginary Vessels, out with the wonderful Copper Canyon Press. Paisley, would you mind sharing another poem from the book?
I will talk about another poem. When It Is Over, It Will Be Over is the title of the poem, and it takes its title from a line by Edna St. Vincent Millay. But I was actually coming across that line via a pen and ink painting reproduction by an artist named Troy Passy. And he's a what we call, I guess, a gestural painter. He doesn't paint objects or anything like that. He'll take a line of verse or a line from a novel, and he'll write it in sometimes interesting spirals or shapes, or just have a blank canvas with that phrase written on it. And I saw this actually in Boise, the Boise Art Museum, so I had been back in the States, and I was so struck by the way in which this line by Edna St. Vincent Millay, he just wrote it over and over and over and over and over in this big sort of hurricane of words, and it was just awe-inspiring. It was a huge canvas.
Wow.
So I thought about that, and I wanted to create a poem that sort of duplicated that effect.
Mm-hmm.
So the poem is really one long sentence.
Okay.
When it is over, it will be over. Hurricane of what must be, only feeling, the painting sentence circling to black on blank, ever tightening spiral of words collapsing to their true gesture, meaning what we read when not reading, as the canvas buckles in the damp, freckled, like the someone I once left sleeping in a hotel room to swim the coast's cold shoals, fine veils of sand kicked up by waves where I found myself enclosed in light, sudden, bright tunnel of minnows like scatterings of diamond, seed pearl whorled in the same thoughtless thought around me, one column of scale turning at a moment's decision, a gesture I was inside or out of, not touching but moving in accord with them. They would not wait for me, thickening, then breaking apart as I slid inside, reading me for threat or flight by the lift of my arm, as all they needed to know of me was in the movement, as all this sentence breaks down to O's and I's, the remnants of someone's desires or mine, so that no matter whether I return to that cold coast, they will never be there, the minnows, in their bright spiraling, first through sight, then through memory, the barest shudderings of sense, O and I, parting the mouth with the cry that contains but doesn't need any meaning.
And that is Paisley Rechtel reading from her brand new book, Imaginary Vessels. What a beautiful poem. Thank you for sharing that one with us, Paisley. I want to actually kind of switch gears a little bit, take you back a ways to the beginning of your writing career. One of the first books, actually the first book of yours that I read and was actually very influential to me early on in my own start, was The Night My Mother Met Bruce Lee. That was a great book. I loved it. I laughed. I enjoyed it. And I thought, one day I too shall write a book about my mother meeting, not Bruce Lee, but I don't know, maybe somebody else.
Yeah.
No, it was just a great collection of stories or essays. And, you know, I loved it. And then after that, I'm aware that you wrote another book of nonfiction. And then this fifth collection of poetry. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Right. And so how is it for you sort of sliding back and forth between these two genres, you know, writing poetry and then going back to nonfiction? How's that been?
Well, I mean, it's a good question because, honestly, I think I tend to work on a book of nonfiction and a book of poetry simultaneously, and they work on sort of similar thematic levels, but they go in wildly different directions.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, with next year, I have a book coming out about a violent stabbing at the grocery store near my house.
Wow.
A young Vietnamese-American man purchased a knife. He was homeless, and he had problems with drug and alcohol addiction. Mm-hmm. He seemed to have experienced a psychotic break. He purchased a knife in this grocery store and then went outside and started deliberately stabbing only white men while screaming about the Vietnam War.
Wow.
And I'd been living in Vietnam at the time, and I just thought, wow, that is a crazy story. Because I read about it on Facebook. Friends had posted, and he stabbed many people, or tried to stab many people. He did stab and almost killed one of our students at the, in the English program. And so I paid some attention. I thought, wow, that is an amazing story. And I came back, and I had forgotten about the case, but I started researching it again because I was like, what happened? And it turns out he had not gone to trial yet because of many complicating factors. But at the time when I was living in Vietnam, I was thinking a lot about memorials and trauma, and because there's so many memorials of war and the ways in which their memorials of war look are very different than the memorials of war that we have here in the United States, especially around the Vietnam War, what they would call the American War. And that informed a whole series of poems, you know, that come with the photographs of the skulls in imaginary vessels.
Yes.
When I got back, I thought, I've got to know why this young man did this, because he was of an age where he never would have experienced the Vietnam War personally.
Right.
And so I started doing research, investigative journalism, and then taking oral histories of Vietnamese Americans who live in Salt Lake City. And it turns out that from the Southeast Asian refugee crisis, there's a long legacy of trauma that has worked its way into the community. There's higher rates of mental illness, addiction, violence. And it's sort of known about in Asian American cultures, but it's not talked about in the national media. And so his story started becoming very emblematic to me about the ways in which we forget about the long effects of war. And when we think about the memorialization of war, we tend to sort of shut things down. We're like, oh, this happened to a certain group of people, like white and African-American soldiers fought over there and died. This memorial is for them. But there's hundreds of thousands of other people who are affected by war, whether through the trauma that their parents experienced, through direct trauma they themselves have experienced, through rape or abuse, all sorts of things. And there's no memorial for those people. And there's no way of talking about those people. And so, you know, I try to talk about the idea of memorializing people, or what is it like to come across the skull of somebody you don't know, and what is that like? And I could address that with a poem, but I thought there's something larger there. And so that clearly was a nonfiction story. And so for me, I see the book that's coming out is called The Broken Country. One about The Broken Country. It'll be out in September. And that to me is paired the twin of imaginary vessels. And I feel like Intimate was the twin of Animal Eye. A Crash of Rhinos was the twin of The Night My Mother Met Bruce Lee. Right. They end up talking about some similar issues, but they have to go in wildly different directions because prose gives you the space to talk about things that you... it's really hard to get into a poem without it becoming didactic. So.
Yeah, right. And so the book then is prose, the one that's going to be coming out.
Yes, yeah. And Wonderful. It's a sort of, it's hybrid only in the sense that to talk about what I want to talk about, it moves through different types of nonfiction writing. So I do oral histories, I do investigative journalism, I do a bit of cultural history. And then I do some bits of, you know, my story that's kind of woven in a little bit there to sort of contextualize why I'm interested in this. And, you know, like many people of my age, I've, you know, my uncle, my father are veterans of Vietnam. My dad is a non-combat veteran, and my uncle was a combat veteran who was highly decorated for his service. And my uncle who fought over there is Asian American, he's Chinese American. And I always wondered what it would be like to go and fight and almost die in a country, you know, where the enemy looks a lot like you. So, and he's been very reticent about that. That's partly also motivating the book, which is the question of, like, why don't we talk about the war in our family? What does this mean? So.
Absolutely. And that book, we'll be looking out for that one. That's called The Broken Country.
Yes.
Wow, that sounds really compelling. I'm going to definitely have to pick that up, and we'll have to have you back on the show for that one as well. We have about 2 minutes left. Would you mind taking us out with one more poem?
I'll take you out with a short one.
Cool.
There's a whole series of poems dedicated to Mae West, who's an actress that I grew up obsessed with. And some of the sonnets are anagrammatical. Okay. They are anagrams of famous one-liner of hers. And this is an anagrammatical sonnet of one of her famous one-liners, which you'll hear at the very end, and I'll unfortunately do a terrible Mae West impression.
What page is that on? Because I have the book in here, and I want to try and find that.
It's page 38.
Okay, 38. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Self-portrait as Mae West one-liner. I'm no moaning bluet, mountable linnet, mumbling nun. I'm tangible, I'm gin, able to molt in toto to limb. I'm blame and angle, I'm lumbago, an oblate mug gone notable, not glum. I'm a taboo tuba mogul, I'm motile, I'm nimble. No gab on we, no bagel bunboat, I'm one big megaton bolt, able to bail men out. Gluten I am, male bong unit. I'm a genial bum, mental obi, genital montage. I'm agent limbo, my blunt bio, an amulet, an enigma. Omit Alan, omit bingo. Alien mangle, I'm glib lingo. Untangle me, Tangelo. Ooh, but I'm no angel.
That's wonderful. And again, you are listening to the poet Paisley Rechdel reading from her brand new collection of poetry, Imaginary Vessels, out with Copper Canyon Press. You'll definitely want to be sure to pick that up. And we barely even skimmed the surface of this book, I know, Paisley, because I loved the anagrams throughout. And then, of course, in the back, we have the sort of, I guess, like frastics on the human skulls. Those are really interesting as well. I look forward to reading more of your work, and I hope all of our listeners out there will pick up this book, and I have no doubt that they will really love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on our show, Paisley, and good luck with everything.
Thank you. You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'd like to thank our special guest today, the poet Paisley Rechdel, and we have been speaking about her new book, Imaginary Vessels, out with Copper Canyon Press. And we'd also like to give thanks to our wonderful producer back there, Kimberly Garcia. Thank you so much. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. We'll see you next week, same time, same place on KTEP 88.5 FM.